You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. You're tuned to This Week in Radio News. I'm Tom Rowe in the Wave Farm Study Center in upstate New York. This week on This Week in Radio, California-based radio artist Remus Samitis discusses two new exhibitions, one in California, one in Indianapolis, one with sculpted radio, and another tuning in long waves. We'll also learn more about long wave radio and how it may soon be in danger in the UK. We'll hear how the ARRL petitions the FCC to allow open source electronics. We'll hear about an app that creates mesh networks and hear about how Apple is blocking its news app in China, and finally about webcaster royalty rates being decided. The digital age and the do-it-yourself movement often conflict, as hacking electronics are sometimes banned or made difficult. The ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, is asking the FCC to clear up if amateur radio licensees may modify non-amateur equipment for use on amateur radio frequencies. In March 2014, the FCC updated requirements for UN2 devices using 5 GHz bandwidth that include many Wi-Fi devices and routers with regulatory language that might not allow altering the devices. In an October 8th comment on a notice of proposed rulemaking in ET docket number 15170 and RM11673, the ARRL wrote, quote, "The commission should clarify that the ability of licensed radio amateurs to modify and adapt non-amateur equipment for use in the amateur service is beneficial, is permitted, and is not restricted by any rule or general applicability adopted in this proceeding," unquote. The ARRL also asked the FCC not to apply any limitations proposed for software-defined radios and address the problem of marijuana grow lights and AM and amateur radio interference. The FCC is overhauling the process where any device that might emit radio waves has to be approved to get that little FCC sticker. Electronic ballast using 1,000-watt high-pressure sodium or metal halide lamps have interfered with certain radio signals, with a few police officers using AM radios in their vehicle radios to locate illegal indoor marijuana growing operations by listening for interference. The ARRL said, quote, "The only opportunity to preclude widespread sale and deployment of non-compliant RF devices, including unintentional emitters, is via the equipment authorization process." Wired reports about the FireChat app from the company Open Garden. FireChat and the similar Serval project build mesh networks by connecting smartphones via the device's Bluetooth or peer-to-peer Wi-Fi. Every smartphone with the FireChat app then becomes a node that can carry and deliver text messages. People can build their own decentralized networks without any corporate or governmental interference. Quote, "In a sense, it's like a blind postman," unquote, says Christopher Dalligalt, Open Garden's chief marketing officer. FireChat launched in the spring of 2014, and it has been used during protests in Iraq, France, and Ecuador, and also in natural disasters. During student protests in Hong Kong recently, more than 500,000 people downloaded the app over a couple of days. Quote, "FireChat works on phones as long as they're less than 200 feet apart, but in times when the density is spotty, the company uses Greenstone, a little plastic module that stores messages and uses Bluetooth to extend the network," unquote, Wired reports. The company hopes that enough people will use the app that they can turn it into a totally free mobile carrier that could replace one's paid phone service. Quote, "I don't know when we'll cross the chasm so that this technology will become ubiquitous enough that everyone can benefit from it," unquote, says Dalligalt from Open Garden. The New York Times reported October 10th that Apple disabled its news app in China. The new app debuted in June in the United States with testing in England and Australia. Users find it works overseas but not in China, with instead an error message, quote, "Can't refresh right now. News isn't supported in your current region," unquote. Larry Salabra, who founded software testing service Pay for Bugs, said on Reddit last week, quote, "They're censoring news content that I downloaded and stored on my device purchased in the USA before I even enter China just because my phone happens to connect to a Chinese signal floating over the border," unquote. Salabra in Hong Kong proved Apple isn't using location tracking and geofencing to shut down the news app, but is basing shutdowns on the mobile network where the phone is connected. Apple also disables the Apple Maps this way in favor of a Beijing-approved map service. Salabra says that the concern here is if Apple is watching real-time cell network data to make changes to a device, even if location services are disabled in their privacy settings. Kevin Goldberg reports in the Communications Law blog that webcasting rates for 2016-2020 may be set soon, and he writes webcasters have reasons for optimism. Copyright Royalty Board is concluding its Webcasting 4 proceeding and has issued two orders so far, and the Register of Copyrights has issued a separate ruling. The CRB has adopted a settlement agreement between Sound Exchange and College Broadcasters Incorporated, which approved terms applying to non-commercial educational webcasters. That agreement is the same as before, with one exception that works in webcasters' favor. CRB also adopted a partial settlement negotiated by both Sound Exchange and National Public Radio for public radio broadcasters. Commercial webcasters, though, lack the lobby power of the other two groups and have not made a settlement with the CRB yet. But the Register of Copyrights recently issued a memorandum saying direct licensing agreements between webcasters and record labels can be entered into evidence and considered by the CRB to decide rates. Quote, "I'm guessing that CRB's final decision won't appear until mid-December," unquote, Goldberg writes, basing his prediction on when the CRB acted in 2010. Read the complete details about the agreement so far at the Communication Law blog. James Careless in Radio World has a long story about longwave radio and its inevitable demise in England. Longwave, as the name suggests, are long waves. Near AM on the dial, and in the UK largely in the 148.5 to 253 kHz range. Like AM radio, transmitting requires a large antenna to create that big wave, and the sound quality means broadcasting music does not work. Recently, Irish state broadcaster Radio Talifs Éireann announced it would end its longwave Radio 1 service to Britain January 1st, but the same Radio 1 programming would still be available on the web and via the Freesat satellite TV service. Longwave loyalists, many of them Irish, who listened for Irish news from inside England, though, successfully protested and petitioned and persuaded the government to postpone RTE's longwave closure until January 1st, 2017. It was the third attempt to end longwave in England that was put off. Eventually, though, the transmissions will end. The BBC has bought up the entire world supply of a specially crafted 1-meter-tall glass valve, but they will run out of those in a few years. Quote, "We have purchased whatever parts we can find, but the truth is that when our current longwave transmission equipment becomes irreparable, our longwave service will be off-air for good," unquote, Dennis Nolan, network manager for BBC Radio 4, said. Quote, "The BBC has committed to continue to sustain the medium for as long as the current infrastructure is viable, but that's it," unquote. You can read the full story about longwave radio at Radio World. Next up, we're talking to Remus Simaitis, a radio artist based in California who's got two new exhibitions, one in California and one in Indianapolis, one with a sculpted radio and another tuning in longwave. Simaitis's Octoloop Rover is at the Charles James Gallery in LA's Chinatown through October 17th, and a series of radio pours is at the Indianapolis Arts Center through November 21st. You can go to rksim.com for more information about Remus Simaitis. We are now speaking to
Remus Simaitis.
Simaitis,
yes.
Who is a California-based artist who has a work in Record, Collect, Compose, an exhibit at the Charlie James Gallery in Los Angeles through October 17th. Your Octoloop Rover is included. You want to tell us what that is?
Yeah, the Octoloop Rover is a sculpture that is sort of derived from the appearance of a lunar rover or a Mars rover. And on attached to the rover itself...
So there. it looks like one of those things you'd see rolling around Mars or the moon or something.
Yeah, and it's kind of funky. It's got these big beach tires on it. It's supposed to look a little childish or childlike in appearance, sort of DIY. It's made out of PVC. And attached to it is this octagon-shaped antenna, which is about 3 feet in diameter. And inside of this antenna, there is a 500-foot length of copper wire that's coiled inside this pipe. And that antenna is a magnetic loop antenna that was designed to receive low-frequency radio signals. So for this particular project, I hooked the antenna up to a receiver that picked up radio signals anywhere from about 10 kilohertz up to 100 kilohertz or so. And I brought the rover out to a bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean and spent some time maybe a month or two ago and picked up some pretty strange radio signals, which I think were coming from a nearby naval base. So I used those images in the software to create visualizations of those radio signals and had those woven into a tapestry, which is also on display at the exhibit at Charlie James Gallery.
And to sort of give people a visual image in their head, I'm wondering, did you create the Octoloop rover, the octagon shape? It looks to me like a giant transparent stop sign.
Right.
Did you create it for that reason, or did you create it specifically to receive certain frequencies?
Well, I found instructions and some information online of people that have already built antennas for these low frequencies, and the Octoloop was one that the instructions were sort of readily available, and it was tried and tested. And since this was my first time building an antenna to receive these low frequencies, I just went with those. And so it was this project. There's a whole group of people on the internet that have posted information and have these very low frequency observatories that you can find online. The website that I go for a lot of my information is vlf.it, and there's a lot of excellent information there on how to build your own receivers and your own antennas.
And VLF stands for very low frequencies, right?
Yes.
So low, what does that mean in terms of frequency? It means it's a giant wave or it's a very small wave?
It's a giant wave. And so some of these frequencies, the wavelengths are as long as 10 kilometers. And typically, you know, there's 500 feet of wire in this one particular antenna. But if I were to attempt to transmit at these frequencies, the antennas would have to be miles in length. And so it's kind of fascinating to research antenna structures that are mainly used by the military, because these low frequency radio signals can travel underwater. And so the Navy uses these frequencies to communicate with their submarines, and they have these massive antenna structures built around the globe and around the country that they use to transmit these signals. And so
there's some controversy around that too, because whales transmit largely around those same frequencies and supposedly are bombarded by these sonar naval frequencies.
Right, which is actually one of the things I'm working on researching for my next project. Is I've been researching even lower frequencies than 10 kilohertz, which is about as low as I can get right now with my current equipment. But you can tune in and listen to radio signals that are created by the Earth's auroras and lightning storms and these naturally emitted radio signals. And what I've found very peculiar is that these auroral choruses, they sound very similar to dolphin and whale signals. And so that's sort of where my work is headed at this point. And what I'm excited about is trying to find a correlation or, you know, is curious that these low frequencies can penetrate the ocean and that these cetaceans also communicate with noises that sound incredibly similar. So
are you saying perhaps the whales and dolphins are listening to the Earth and sort of mimicking it or trying to talk back to the Earth?
I'm not sure, but I'd like to find out somehow. So that's what I'm going to try to do for my next project. But it's pretty exciting. I just had that epiphany very recently when I was listening to another radio enthusiasts' recordings of the auroral choruses.
This is a side note. We'll go up a few kilohertz in frequency to 52 kilohertz. Do you know about the loneliest whale in the world?
I have heard about the loneliest whale in the world, and apparently it it communicates at a different frequency than
the
other.
52 kilohertz is, I think, and the whales are mostly around 12 or 13 or something. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. But
this,
yeah,
one whale they found listens or hears or talks or speaks in the Navy has picked up this 52 kilohertz signal and can track it around the Pacific Ocean. But it's the only whale that supposedly they can pick up speaking at this kilohertz. So it's considered the loneliest whale in the world since no one else can hear it.
Right. And it's, to my understanding, it's some sort of a genetic defect for this one particular whale. So unfortunately, it can't communicate with any of its friends.
So let's go back to the 10 to 20 kilohertz frequencies, which you're dealing with. So what goes on those frequencies?
Well, you know, due to the limitations of transmitting at those frequencies, there's not a lot of activity. There are different military, Russian military and the U.S. Navy, they set up transmitters to communicate with submarines, but there's also beacons that aircraft and ships can tune into that are sort of these non-directional beacons that particular frequencies are assigned to particular transmitters at the globe. And so if you know which transmitter you're listening for, you tune into that frequency, and then through some math and computation, you can kind of figure out where you are on the globe. But
because these long frequencies are a little like AM compared to FM. AM is a much bigger, larger wave. It travels much farther, but the sound quality is much less. So you can't really, it's not good for music. You can talk. These right. waves are even longer, so they can travel farther, which would give the military a use for them. And they also have less sound quality, so they're better for tones and beeps and random noise.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, and those, I know I've picked up, I think there's a regular transmission happening at around 23 or 24 kilohertz, which is pretty easy to pick up, but it's pretty strange tinkering at those low frequencies to see what's out there. And for this particular project, the image that I have on display at the gallery were these signals that I picked up, and they were right around 10 kilohertz, and there was an extremely wide bandwidth signal, and I'm not quite sure what it was. I did I tried to figure it out while I was on site, but all I could think was I was, you know, maybe a few miles south of Point Mugu Naval Base, which I've chatted with some other radio enthusiasts, and they have some very powerful transmitters there. And so
they have large antennas there?
I'm not sure about the antenna systems they have, but this one particular signal, I had never seen anything like it with as long as I've been using this equipment. So it was pretty exciting to pick up on it, and I had to kind of make sure that it wasn't an equipment malfunction, and I'm pretty sure because I haven't been able to get to replicate the signal anywhere else besides that particular time and place. And so, yeah, the software that I use is sort of a radio spectrogram.
Yeah, you said seen. What do you mean by you saw the signal rather than heard it?
Well, so I work with this software that visualizes the radio spectrum, and you can I hook it up to some radio equipment and radio receivers that I have, and it allows you to see where the different transmissions are, what frequency they're coming in at. And so I had the software set up, and I kind of tweak it to create abstracted images. So they're the data visualization purposes are obscured, and it becomes more of an aesthetic practice. But this one particular signal, you know, I've looked with like FM transmissions, there's typically the center frequency and then the side bands. And this particular signal, it was very wide bandwidth and had, I don't know, maybe a dozen side bands on each side that were all coming in very strongly. And so, yeah, in the time that I've been working with this software and this equipment, I've never seen anything like it. And so I sort of the radio receiver becomes a drawing tool of sorts, and I can tweak the frequencies with the tuning knob and sort of create these abstract, geometric, sort of visionary in appearance, these images. And yeah, so it was kind of exciting because I had, like I said, I'd never seen anything like it before.
And you're kind of attempting to let people who come to see your work be able to visualize all the invisible waves that are bombarding them.
Right. And so what I've been learning, and I think a good way of thinking about the work that I'm doing, is the fact that radio signals are a form of light. They're, you know, visible light is a very small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. And there are, you know, above frequencies higher and lower than visible light are still forms of light. They're just not what we commonly think of as visible light. And so
you think of it like in terms of other animals see different ways, like some don't see colors or something, and we can't visualize those forms of light.
Right. And then even beyond that, you know, like X-rays, for instance, can penetrate material and matter, and then infrared on the other end bounces off material. And so that's where light can act as both a particle and a wave, where sometimes it penetrates material and sometimes it bounces off of it. And so radio signals have many different applications. Certain frequencies are better at penetrating matter. Those higher frequencies, microwave signals used for Wi-Fi and cell phones. And then, you know, radar frequencies are designed to bounce off of matter and be received back at the site where they're transmitted. And so it's kind of fascinating to think of radio signals as these invisible forms of light that are constantly bouncing around and penetrating different matter. And I'm just working on ways that kind of make this form of light tangible, or give people a way that they can perceive it in some form.
I never thought about it sort of that way. It's like if you could hear bats, then bats would run into things.
Right.
So give me a visual picture of if someone comes into the Charlie James Gallery, what do they see when they see the Octoloop rover?
Well, so this exhibition was curated by a friend of mine, Masood Kamandi, and he's a photographer. And so the premise of the exhibition, there's, I think, five other artists, and the premise is sort of these abstract approaches to photography. And you know, photography is working with light and trying to interpret light. And so there's these photographers that have different approaches. Some are using your regular digital camera receives spectrums of light that humans can't see, and then it processes those images to sort of replicate what a normal traditional camera would produce. And so there's a friend of mine, Martin Elder, who works with the spectrums that the digital camera sort of erases in its process of creating the image, and creates these sort of very colorful, saturated images. And there's a couple other photographers in the show that are working with sort of abstracted approaches to photography. And so the exhibition itself is in the basement gallery at Charlie James. And so you walk down the stairs, and it's sort of this low ceiling basement area. And there's the sculpture hanging in the center of the room, and then there's a couple different photographs and objects on the wall, and my work is off to the right corner, and there's the Octoloop rover itself, which is maybe 6 feet tall and
it's 6 feet. Dune buggy size?
Yeah, it's dune buggy size. It looks like something you could ride if it was rideable, but it wasn't created or intended to be rideable. Its purpose was to support the antenna, and then there's a small bamboo platform that I put my equipment on while I was in the field. And then adjacent to the rover is the image, which I had woven into a tapestry, and then I hand-dyed the image, so it's got a sort of turquoise color to it. And it's got this sort of psychedelic visionary appearance to it, which, I don't know, similar, I guess, to something you might, like Alex Gray might produce or something like that.
And I see you also have a show called Radio Pores, in exhibition in, Indianapolis through November 21st. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is a show. I was actually, while I was doing my residency at Wave Farm, the curator contacted me and wanted to see if my work was available for the show. But it's a series of radio sculptures that I created at the Oxbow School of Art a few years ago. And basically, I was just, my friends were working in the metal foundry, and they sort of invited anyone that wanted to do a project to come experiment. And I was trying to figure out a way how to make these more formal objects and have them be applicable to my own interests. And so what I ended up doing, I went to a bunch of antique stores in the region and picked up these sort of these vintage plastic radios. I think the oldest one was probably from the 70s or 80s, maybe. So not too vintage, but and I basically,
are these the Bakelite radios or just what kind of
newer than the Bakelite ones? There's some old Panasonic radios, and then sort of these. One of them was from, looked like it was probably from the 90s. It's sort of pink and yellow and blue. So what I ended up doing is, I was experimenting with pouring molten metal into the radios themselves to create these objects. And so we were working with a very simplified form of metal casting where we basically attach a sprue, or which is sort of a funnel that you would pour the metal into, and bury these radios in the sand and pour metal into them. And so I did a couple with molten aluminum and a couple with molten bronze. And basically, once you pour the metal into the plastic radio, it melts and burns out the plastic, and the metal takes its place. And so these radios really look like something you might see in the Terminator movie, sort of part android or part machine, part radio. They all turned out a little bit different. And But they're formal objects. They're physical radios. The show is called Plain Airs, which is sort of a, I guess the curator wanted to get a group of artists that were working with a different approach to realism. So, that show is up at the Indianapolis Art Center through November 21st.
And is the kind of pour a kind of metaphor for the bombardment of frequencies to the radios? I mean, they receive this endless pour.
Well, I haven't thought of it that way. The titles that I typically give my sculptures are quite literal most of the time, but
people can accept them however they want, then, I guess.
Yeah, and that's a good interpretation. So,
and that show is at the what is the name of the gallery?
It's the Indianapolis Art Center.
Indianapolis Art Center, and that's through November 21st. And we're speaking, if you just joined us, with Remus Simultis, do you have other shows you've got coming up, or you want to give us a website address, or if people want more information?
Yeah, my work or my personal website is rksim.com. It's rksim.com. And right now, these are the two shows that I have up right now, and I'm just working, as I mentioned, my future work, trying to work with the auroral choruses and these low-frequency radio signals, and just one step at a time, trying to see where it all takes me. So,
and you may discover if whales can communicate with the Earth.
Yeah, we'll see. That's an exciting lead to follow, and whether or not it pans out to anything, I think the metaphors and the sort of poetic gesture in the project could be powerful.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today and talking about radio waves.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.